What are the factors making the landlocked West African country of Mali strategic for outside interests? What is at stake for the West as the U.S.-backed government in Mali negotiates with rebel forces for a draft agreement for peace and national reconciliation? Who are the Tuareg people, and what claim do they have to the territory of Aziwad in the country's northeast? How did children come to be laborers involved in mining gold in Mali? And how is their health being compromised, and what can be done to stop this practice? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we will explore all these questions with Abayomi Azikiwe, editor of Pan-African Newswire, John Sherto of Intercontinental Cry, and Mektor Menta, a Malian filmmaker trying to document the abuses of child minors in Mali. On this week's program, Spotlight on Mali, Tuareg Resistance, Minor Miners, and the Geopolitical Football. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 5th, 2014. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. You can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Independent analysts as well as OSCE monitor Michael Mochirku have rather mentioned no signs of a missile could be found on the wreckage, only machine gun-like holes. Evidence which corroborates the Spanish air traffic controller's testimony, who claimed Ukrainian fighter jets had shot MH17 down. Eyewitnesses on the ground have also told the BBC Russian service that they saw Ukrainian fighter jets next to MH17 before it crashed. It poses a serious problem that Ukraine is part of an investigation into an incident for which it is a suspect, when the main victim, Malaysia, is excluded. The investigation should either include all the suspects as well as the victims or none of them. But most importantly, Ukraine should not lead an investigation into a crime for which it is a suspect. That comes from the article, Ukraine, a suspect in crime, involved in the MH17 criminal investigation, by Julie Levesque, posted December 3rd. Why is manipulation of the price of gold in the futures market not investigated and prosecuted? The answer to the question is that suppressing the price of gold helps to protect the U.S. dollar's value from the excessive debt and money creation of the past 6 years. The attacks on gold also enable the bullion banks to purchase large blocks of shares in the GLD Gold Trust that can be redeemed in gold with which to supply Asian purchasers. Whether or not the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury are instigators of the price manipulation, government authorities tolerate it as it supports the dollar's value in the face of an enormous creation of new dollars and new federal debt. In other words, the illegal rigging of the price of gold in the futures market is deemed by the U.S. government to be essential to the success of its economic policy, just as illegal torture, illegal military invasions, and attacks on sovereign countries, unconstitutional violation of habeas corpus, unconstitutional spying on U.S. citizens, and illegal and unconstitutional murder of U.S. citizens by the executive branch are essential to the U.S. government's war on terror. That comes from the article, Market Manipulation of the Gold Market, U.S. Resorts to Illegality to Protect Failed Financial Policies, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts and Dave Kranzler, posted December 3rd, originally appearing at paulcraigroberts.org. The resolution calls for Russia to stop supporting local militias in eastern Ukraine and for the cancellation of Crimea's decision to join Russia. In addition, it calls on Moscow to withdraw its troops, which the U.S. claims are in Ukraine, Georgia, and Moldova. Thursday's resolution also urges NATO members and U.S. allies to suspend military cooperation with Russia. Addressing Obama, the House urged him to review the readiness of U.S. and NATO armed forces under the Conventional Armed Forces in Europe Treaty, CFE. That comes from the article, Breaking, Adoption of House of Representatives Resolution Provides De Facto Green Light to Obama to Declare War on Russia. Posted December 4th, originally appearing as a report for RT. How many Americans know that the current regime in Ukraine was installed in a very bloody February 2014 coup d'etat that was planned in the U.S. White House and overseen by an Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, and run by the CIA and carried out for the White House by one of Ukraine's two racist, fascist, or Nazi political parties, whose founder and leader still controls Ukraine, though not officially, even these many months after his coup, and which Nazi party has been up to their elbows since then in a genocidal policy to exterminate the people in the region of Ukraine that had voted approximately 90% for the man whom Obama and those Nazis overthrew in February. And how many Americans know that one of the two main suspects in the bringing down of the Malaysian MH17 airliner over Ukraine on July 17th has been given veto power over the report that is to be issued from the official investigation of the black boxes and other evidence in the case? Virtually all of the news editors and producers, the news executives in America's press, know and have known all along that these things are the case because they've been receiving many news submissions on them, with full and entirely credible documentation each time, ever since February, and have not made any of these facts public. They've not published this reality when it was news, though they are supposed to be news organizations. I know this because I am one of the many independent investigative journalists who has been reporting in detail on these matters throughout this time period and whose reports have been submitted to virtually all U.S. news media, mainstream and alternative news, liberal and conservative news, Republican and Democratic news. And with the exception of only about a half dozen obscure but admirably authentic news sites on the internet, which is just a small fraction of the alternative news sites, all of this solidly documented information, just click on the links and you'll see it documented there, has been intentionally withheld from the American public by virtually the entirety of the U.S. news media. That comes from the article, The Biggest Scandal in America is Its Controlled Press, by Eric Zeus, posted December 3rd. Russia is launching a new national defense facility, which is meant to monitor threats to national security in peacetime, but would take control of the entire country in case of war. The new top security fortified facility in Moscow includes several large war rooms, a brand new supercomputer in the heart of a state-of-the-art data processing center, underground facilities, secret transport routes for emergency evacuation, and a helicopter pad, which was deployed for the first time on November 24th on the Moscow River. The Defense Ministry won't disclose the price tag for the site, but it is estimated at the equivalent of several billion dollars. In peacetime, an additional task is to monitor all of Russia's important military assets, from hardware being produced by defense contractors to the state of oil refineries to weather conditions and their effect on transportation routes. And if Russia does get into a war, the center would act as a major communication hub and a form of wartime government, delivering reports to the country's military command and giving orders to all ministries, state-owned companies, and other organizations according to the needs of the armed forces. That comes from the article, Moscow Launches Wartime Government Which Would Take Control of Russian Federation in the Case of War, posted December 3rd, originally appearing as a report for RT. Russia has abandoned the troubled South Stream project and will now be building its replacement with Turkey. In what may possibly be the biggest move towards multipolarity thus far, the ultimate Eurasian pivot, Turkey, has done away with its former Euro-Atlantic ambitions. Turkey is still anticipated to have some privileged relations with the West, but the entire nature of the relationship has forever changed as the country officially engages in pragmatic multipolarity. Turkey's leadership made a major move by sealing such a colossal deal with Russia in such a sensitive political environment, and the old friendship can never be restored, nor do the Turks want it to be. It's amazing how much the West lost in such a short period of time and due to such major and totally unnecessary political miscalculations, and they owe their roots to the disastrous regime change operations in Syria and Ukraine. That comes from the article Cold Turkey, Ankara Buckles Against Western Pressure, Turns to Russia, by Andrew Korybko, posted December 3rd, originally appearing at Oriental Review. Reports indicate Obama will nominate Carter as new defense secretary. Carter is unabashedly dohawkish, arguing for intervening before mortal threats to U.S. security can develop. In other words, maintaining preemption is an option. If confirmed, he'll hit the ground running. That comes from the article, New Boss at the Pentagon, The Nomination of Ashton Carter Means More War, by Stephen Lendman, post December 3rd. There was a time when charts were very reliable. This changed many years ago. I was changed because if you go back to 1988, President Reagan, by executive order, created the Working Group on Financial Markets as a result of the 87 crash, otherwise known as the Plunge Protection Team, to prevent stock market crashes. Initially, this may have been a good idea with good intentions. The problem is this. The PPT has morphed into something out of the old USSR, which tries to manage everything, everywhere, always. This obviously changes the value of charts. If they can be painted, they are, then they don't show a true picture. Rather, they show a picture those doing the painting want you to see. That comes from the article, Trading Pattern in Gold and Silver Has Changed Drastically. What Happens Next? By Bill Holter, posted December 3rd. The pursuit of white supremacy, both domestically and globally, is the singular unifying engine driving the West's ongoing hegemony around the world. Reduced to the old canard of race relations, whatever that is supposed to mean, it can be encapsulated in Rodney King's much maligned plaint, "Can't we all just get along?" Certainly not amid the flood of feigned perplexion, mock incredulity, and the toxic both sides rhetoric that still spews forth from the mouths of whites, and not a small number of non-whites, at every level of society, media, and social interaction. Not unless and until white people change and begin to see the structural and institutional evil that white supremacy injects into every facet of American life. That comes from the article, The White People Problem in America, by Daniel Patrick Welch, who posted December 4th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Instability in Mali intensified in January 2012 when fighting broke out with the Tuareg rebel groups in the north led by the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad. A military coup ousted President Amadou Toumani Touré, citing his failure to put down the rebellion, and in April of 2012, the MNLA succeeded in seizing the region to the northwest known as Azawad. Shortly thereafter, the extremist Islamist groups working with the Tuareg, including Ansar Dine and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, took control of the north themselves and attempted to institute Sharia law. In January of the following year, French forces intervened at the behest of the interim government and worked alongside them to take the territory back from the Islamists. In the time since, the Malian government has engaged the Tuareg rebel groups in negotiations, most recently in Algiers, to hammer out some sort of agreement for peace and national reconciliation. Mali is Africa's eighth largest country. It is a major producer of gold and other precious metals. Could the U.S. and other outside interests be influencing or capitalizing on the instability there in order to further their interests? Joining us now to put the present negotiations in a geopolitical context is Abayomi Azikiwe. He's the editor of Pan-African Newswire. His articles appear regularly on Global Research. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Azikiwe.
Thank you.
Now, you've written extensively on the subject of U.S.-NATO imperialism on the African continent and challenged some of the narratives around Western interventions there. As these inter-Malian dialogues are at work, hammering out a draft agreement for peace and national reconciliation in Mali, what is at stake for the U.S. and other outside interests?
The United States is involved in the West Africa region. They have been involved in the Mali situation from the standpoint of providing assistance to the Malian army. They have trained officers in that country. They have assisted the French in their intervention inside the country since 2013. I believe that they are interested from the standpoint of the mineral resources that exist in Mali as well as neighboring states. They have a lot at stake because it is the objective of the U.S. foreign policy right now to have a large military presence in West Africa.
Okay. Could you expand on that a little bit? I know that, for example, gold is one of Mali is one of the biggest exporters of gold in the world, third largest in Africa, I believe. What are some of the other geostrategic aspects of Mali that makes it so valuable to the U.S.?
It is a very large country, and it borders other countries. For example, Guinea. There's the border with Niger. There's the close proximity to other states in the region, such as Libya and Mauritania, where the United States has interests, where they have been involved in destabilizing governments and replacing certain personalities within governments with other personalities. I think that the United States has consistently, over the last two administrations, enhanced its military presence on the continent, as well as its intelligence operations in Africa. They are very concerned about maintaining control of the entire region. You have strategic minerals. There's also oil, uranium, and other important minerals, not just in Mali, but throughout the entire region of West Africa.
Now, my understanding is that the mineral resources are mostly in the south end of the country. What about the Aziwad area up in the north? Where's the significance? What significance does that area have for the U.S.?
Well, first of all, the situation involving the Twara people has been going on now for many decades. One of the unresolved questions from the legacy of French colonialism. And there have been numerous outbreaks of violence in that region going back to the early 60s. What distinguishes the current crisis today is that the Malian government itself or regional entities have not been able to resolve the conflict internally. It's provided a rationale for the intervention of these outside forces, particularly France, and as I mentioned before, the United States is heavily involved in supporting the French in their intervention in Mali. So I think the question in the north provides them with the rationale for intervention. You also have numerous organizations there who are attempting to vie for influence and authority. They have, in fact, in the area of where the Tuareg population populates, they have, in fact, created a situation where there are numerous organizations, Islamist as well as separatist organizations, that have vied for political dominance in the area. So I don't think that situation is going to be resolved anytime soon. The French went in nearly 2 years ago. They were claiming that their operation would only be for a few months. And in fact, now it's approaching 2 years. So I don't think that they really have a good grasp on what is going on inside the country. And in terms of mineral resources, they also have phosphate, limestone. There's also a potential. They're speculating of extracting petroleum in the Tawadini Basin region in Mali as well. So I think the actual wealth of that nation is significant in terms of the overall West Africa region.
What about competitors, China, for example? Do you see any indications of how China is somehow interacting with this whole situation?
Yeah, the Chinese aid has been significant over the last several years. There's been Chinese and Malian combined companies and combined projects over the last several years. But I think the United States is very concerned about the role of China, as well as other states, in their economic projects in Mali. And that's why they have stepped up their military intervention in the region. I think it's a competition at this point between China and the United States. It seems to take on an economic dimension, but in fact, the U.S. is approaching it from a military perspective. They don't have the capital to invest in these infrastructural projects in Mali. The Chinese have been willing to invest in infrastructural development. So the United States, in order to you know, try to block or try to shore up this gap in regard to cooperation, is offering military assistance and also pulling the strings of other organizations. For example, the World Bank, which is you know, involved in extending loans to Mali, also is influencing the African Development Bank and some of the Arab funds that exist. Then you have the European Union and others who are involved in projects in Mali. So I think the U.S. is using these organizations and their influence within these organizations to have an impact, to outmaneuver China in whatever way they can. They have also worked through the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, the Peace Corps presence there. They've also, in terms of military, the African Crisis Response Initiative, which is something that the U.S. has been pushing, and in effect, to create surrogate armies throughout the West Africa region, ostensibly to fight against terrorism. But it's interesting that some of these so-called terrorist groups, the U.S. has supported in other parts of the continent. For example, in Libya, during the war there in 2011, they actually funded and armed and provided logistical support to some of the groups that they consider terrorists in order to overthrow the Gaddafi government. But then at the same time, in Mali or Niger, they'll act as if they're in opposition to these same groups that they fund and support in other geopolitical regions.
Hmm. So do you see any analog then between like the current campaign against ISIS in Syria and Iraq, and perhaps these Islamist jihadists that have aligned themselves with the independence movement in Azawad?
Yes, and it's not clear if they have aligned themselves with the independence movement in the north of the country. It remains rather obscure that these groups were able to intervene after the main separatist organization had seized territory. Now it's a very muddled situation politically. There's no clear-cut political authority in the area. And I believe that this is going to necessitate, at least from their perspective, the ongoing military presence in the country. And I think that in the past, for example, in the early 60s, when the Malian government was very new under Modibo Keita, they were able to subdue a Tuareg rebellion in the north without you know, any outside assistance or interference. And since that time, they've been able to do it both internally as well as through regional negotiations. The Algerians have been involved in some of these negotiations years ago. But today, through the increased interference vis-a-vis the United States Africa Command and the Malian military, now they're incapable of addressing these their own internal problems. So I don't think AFRICOM is enhancing the security in West Africa. It's actually creating more instability. And if you look at the countries in which they've operated, Burkina Faso and Mali, In Niger, even in Nigeria, there's been a escalation in instability and insurgency. So I think it's having the opposite effect of what the U.S. claims their objectives are in Africa.
Now, you mentioned just a little bit earlier about World Bank loans. I'm reading an article from the Associated Press, headline, IMF resumes loans to Mali frozen because of irregularities, $11.7 million installment paid. And it's quoting the article, says the aid is aimed at helping the West African country return to stability after war with jihadists who seized its north. Mali is now also trying to contain the spread of Ebola. So you're saying that this is all just it's a pretext then.
Yeah, they are. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank were formed by the United States towards the conclusion of World War II, and they have not had a sterling record in Africa at all, and quite despised by the populations there because the type of conditionalities that they impose on these emerging post-colonial states tend to isolate people within the civil service, within the healthcare infrastructure, within the universities and public school systems, and to place more emphasis on maintaining those loans and managing those loans rather than actually building up the country. So they're claiming now that they're going to receive over $11 million of funds that are going to be unfrozen by the International Monetary Fund. And, of course, this perhaps will give a green light to additional funding from perhaps the European Union and other international financial institutions. They claim that these funds were suspended earlier this year because they felt corruption was going on involving military contracts in Mali. But these are issues that most African countries are facing because the post-colonial states, by and large, are unsustainable and unviable. And the fact that Africa has not been able to unite over the last 5 decades is a clear indication of the lack of feasibility of these post-colonial states. Almost all of them are in economic crisis at this point, despite the fact that there's been quantitative economic growth. But in terms of qualitative growth, it's a lot to be desired. And right now, a lot of the countries are facing the prospect of deeper financial crises because of the worldwide decline in commodity prices. Oil prices and other, even agricultural commodities have declined in price. And these countries are almost solely dependent for their foreign exchange earnings from the export of these commodities. So we can see that we're going to have deeper crises in Mali, even in countries like Nigeria, which has been deemed to have the largest economy on the African continent now. The finance minister there made a speech recently telling the people they should brace themselves for an economic downturn. So it's really a perpetual crisis for these post-colonial states in lieu of the lack of unity and coordination of their economies and political systems throughout the region.
Okay. Well, Abiyomi Azikiwe, I want to thank you very much for that analysis of the current situation facing Mali and West Africa generally. Thank you so much for being our guest on the Global Research News Hour.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Abiyomi Azikiwe is editor of Pan-African Newswire, and his articles appear regularly on the Global Research News site. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Okay, so we're joined right now by John Shirto. He is the editor of Intercontinental Cry. We're going to discuss a little bit about some of the less prominent aspects of some of the politics in Mali, particularly with regard to the ongoing negotiations happening between the Tuareg and the Malian government. So, John, thank you very much for joining us.
For sure. Thanks for having me.
Now, I think many, I mean, people who followed the French intervention there, I guess it's almost 2 years ago now, I think that probably could be forgiven if they don't have very much detail on the aspects of the Tuareg resistance. Maybe you could help just by, you know, starting off, we could just get a bit of detail about who they are as a people and their presence in the region. What's some of the historically, where do they fit into that the wider scheme of the Malian governance?
Okay, well, there's actually quite a bit to consider regarding the Tuareg and who they are, and which is, I don't think I've ever seen anybody really talk about who the Tuareg are. So it's worth, definitely worth going over a bit of their culture and their historical experience to put everything in context. The Tuareg are nomadic pastoralists who roamed and still roam in some respects a vast region in North Africa known as Azawad. And that term translates to English as the land of transhumans, which is another word for being nomadic. And the Tuareg are part of a much larger indigenous population in North Africa known as the Amazigh people, which means free people in the indigenous Tamazight language. Among outsiders, the more common, the incorrect name for the Amazigh people is Berber, a term that is largely rejected by the Tuareg and other Amazigh peoples for its negative connotations. The word directly translates to barbarian. Now, as far as the Tuareg's experience goes, I think it's safe to say that it is on par with the colonial experience of most other indigenous peoples around the world, with one very important difference. The Tuareg's colonial experience began during the so-called Scramble for Africa, which began in the late 1800s, in which the Tuareg found their lands being invaded by the French. And Tuareg did their best to, kick the colonizers out, but they ultimately failed in their efforts, and they were subsequently forced to sign treaties in 1905 and in 1917. I'm not particularly sure of the details of the treaties, but the Tuareg had to make concessions. And then when the so-called Rush for Independence began, that is the UN-sanctioned process of political decolonization, the so-called last decolonization process under the UN, when that began in the 1950s, the Tuareg homeland, which is about the size of Texas, was divided into five slices, and those slices going to what is now Mali, Algeria, Mauritania, Niger, and Burkina Faso. And obviously, the Tuareg weren't weren't consulted in any way, or had any real rights, to their land. It was just, they were conquered. They signed their treaties. They're done. But as far as the Tuareg were concerned, that couldn't have been further from the truth. And this is where the Tuareg's story differs from that of many other indigenous nations, because the Tuareg never lost their desire to live independently like other indigenous peoples. But unlike others, they were willing to take up arms to reclaim their land so that they could, once again, roam freely without restriction. And over the past 50 years, the Tuareg have led four major rebellions in order to reclaim their homelands.
the most recent one beginning in January 2012. And this latest rebellion was led by, or uprising rather, I would call it, was led by an organization called the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad, which was founded in October 2011. And their goal was to establish a multi-ethnic homeland called Azawad, which would consist of the region in northern Mali. I'm not sure of the where the bottom border lies, but anyways, it's a fairly significant region. Certainly, one that would you know, provide the Tuareg with the room they needed to live sustainably. Now the situation gets pretty complicated because the MLA knew full well that they wouldn't be able to succeed on their own as they've because they failed on so many other occasions. So they forged alliances with various militant groups, principally among them the Ansar Din and the Movement for the Unity and Jihad in West Africa, with both who have purported ties to Al-Qaeda and who both aspire to establish their own Islamic State.
What would be the motivation to forge that kind of an alliance?
Necessity. The Tuareg are not they don't follow the Islamic beliefs. They have their own way of doing things, but it was just a necessity, I think. You know, I can't speak for them or what their motives were, but I think it's safe to say that it was just out of pure necessity. You know, they knew full well that the Ansar Din, you know, wanted to create a state where that would be ruled under Sharia law, and they knew full well that that wouldn't work for them because that would, you know, exclude their own rights. Right? They would lose their own rights in that kind of system. But the risk was worth the reward, I guess. You know, so they forged those alliances. Hoping that they wouldn't lose everything in the process from the Ansar Din and their associates.
And then we saw the French intervention in early 2013. How did that, which was framed as a war, you know, principally against Islamic jihadists? How did that? What impact did that have on the Tuareg resistance?
I think it had a significant impact. You mean the so-called intervention?
Yes.
Well, the Tuareg were always, as far as the media was concerned, they were always in the background. It wasn't a Tuareg struggle for self-determination under UN, under international law. It was an ethnic separatist group. Was, you know, causing trouble in Mali, and they were being, and they were, I guess, in the passenger seat in many respects to the Ansar Din, the terrorists, basically. And when it came to the intervention, I think what I see is that, like, the situation was really complicated, but the Tuareg, in some respects, ended up fighting against their former allies because, you know, with the collapse of the government and the military junta that came forward, the Ansar Din seized the opportunity because of the power vacuum and started pushing the Tuareg out of the way. So that pushed the Tuareg toward to fight, you know, with France to a certain extent. But France was still going at the Tuareg too, because, you know, their objective wasn't simply to, you know, to crush the Ansar Din. You know, France's objective was to restore Mali to its former glory, I guess. You know, you know, the Tuareg were being pushed and pulled left and right, but ultimately, I think. I don't like saying this, but the intervention worked to a certain extent in the Tuareg's favor, because the French forces, along with all the other forces that were involved with Mali and Algeria and, you know, other forces, were able to force the Islamist guerrillas out of the region for the most part. You know, they retook all the territory that the Ansardin had gained. And that actually gave the MNLA the room that they needed to tentatively regain some of their own control of Azawad. And that also opened the door for negotiations with Mali. Mm-hmm. And those negotiations have been ongoing, not particularly successfully. Right from the get-go, the MNLA agreed to a major concession as a show of good faith. Instead of struggling for an independent, multi-ethnic state, they agreed to settle for a new autonomous province or state that would exist within Mali.
John, is there an analog to that model that maybe would help our listeners understand exactly what the change in the demands they're making?
Not that I'm familiar with, no.
Is this like a brand new model then?
I'd have to think about that for a bit. I don't think it's a new model. I think there are plenty of examples where indigenous peoples have their own, the ability to, truly, fully self-govern themselves, like the Miskito people of Honduras. There's many other examples around the world where indigenous peoples have been able to live, independently without having to, without having a noose around their neck or without having their hands tied. Unfortunately, the way that indigenous governments are structured here in Canada and the U.S., it's not comparable to those governments. What the Mali government is actually counter-proposing is self-administration of local communities, which is exactly how band councils function here in Canada.
Exactly.
And that is a concession that the Tuareg are not willing to make. They don't want to have, a boot on their neck, right? They want to have, their own, they want to be able to truly self-govern them themselves and not to be, utterly accountable to the Malian government and the Malian government's economic, political, social, linguistic interests.
Mm.
And so that's where the negotiations are basically stuck on that point, with the Tuareg, wanting to govern themselves and the Mali government's offering, relatively minor concessions so they can self-administer their own affairs as long as it's convenient for Mali.
Hmm. Well, it'd definitely be interesting to see how things proceed going forward. I wanted to just give you a minute or two to plug your current campaign, because Intercontinental Cry is one of the very few, if not only, publications that are covering indigenous resistance issues around the world on an ongoing basis. Could you just tell us a little bit about people, if they want to support Intercontinental Cry, how they could do so?
Yeah, well, we're in the process now of trying to raise some desperately needed funds so we can keep our work going in 2015. We don't actually receive any kind of funds from governments, corporations, or private foundations. We're totally reader funded, and given the season, it has been very difficult for us to raise funds. We've so far maybe 9 people have donated to us, and unfortunately, if we can't reach our goal, IC is going to be shut down on January 1st. So if there's anybody out there who wants to pitch in or even just visit our work and maybe help get the word out if they see the value in what we're doing, they can visit intercontinentalcry.org. And we're on Facebook too and Twitter as well. So they can, track us down and help out any way that they see fit to.
Well, John Chertow, thank you for contributing to our program, and thank you so much for your work, and
sure,
good luck with your campaign.
Thank you.
John Chertow is the editor of Intercontinental Cry. Was the song Tamiditin Tan Ufrawan from Tinarawin, a Grammy Award-winning group of Tuareg musicians from the northern Mali region. They came together in a Libyan refugee camp in 1979. This song is off their fifth album, Tassili. We turn now to the plight of child mining in Mali. Making his debut on the Global Research News Hour is Mokhtar Menta. Mokhtar Menta is a filmmaker and director of a film project highlighting the plight of children working in artisanal gold mines in Mali. He's here to tell us more about this subject. Thank you for joining us, Mokhtar Menta. Can I ask you, why are children harvesting gold? Why not adults?
Okay, before I go deeply, I want to say that Mali is the third largest producer of gold in the African continent after Ghana and South Africa. So, the gold is the main resource of Malians now. And according to World Bank, Mali is one of the most poor countries in the world. So there are not many possibilities to make money here. And last 2 years ago, we had a big problem of security and rebellion problem here. That made people very power and activities are not going very well. So everyone, what they were seeing to make money is gold. And there are some families, the entire family goes to gold mining. Then when going, the father go with his children. And it's not like children have a choice to go or not, because there are not food in family, so everyone needs to go work. And the children go accompany their parents to make money and to have some food. The problem is that it's not that the children like work in this kind of work, but they have no choice. There are not many possibilities to make all the things. Because I interviewed some one of them who told me that they were in school before. But because that parents cannot pay any more the school, they need to go work with parents to make some money and have food.
Hmm. How young are these children?
Yes, they are from 6 to 18, 14, I want to say. From 6 to 14. They start, the major part of them start at age of 6. And now in Mali, they are from 20,000 to 40,000 children who are working nowadays in Malian artisanal gold mines. They are exposed to toxic mines. They are exposed to all kinds of injuries because working in the pit is not something that is easy. They go down up to 40 meters. Mm-hmm. And working downside, working in such kind of pit is really difficult for a child like 6 years, 8 years, or 14 years.
Hmm. How do these activities affect the health of these children?
Their health is not good at all, because the major part of them also work as in panning to wash the gold. They eat and they get out the mineral. Then they need to wash it. And when washing the gold mineral, they need some chemical product like mercury and other things. Exposing in such kind of chemical product is very dangerous, because if they go back town, there are most of them finished by having some health problems. And the beef is very, very... They dig very often after coming from child from mining. Hmm.
How many children are involved in this practice across Mali?
Across Mali is about 20,000 to 40,000.
There was a report from Human Rights Watch in 2011 documenting a lot of this. Is the situation worse now than it was in 2011?
Yes, there is not a big difference. The Human Rights Watch made a report, but this is a report, and it's only it can be read by government and by many people, but Malian government did not start a real action to end this practice. Now, my goal is to translate this kind of report in video, in image, so that the world can see it. Because, like they say, one image can express one image express real time what a text can say. You tell me that maybe this report cannot reach as many as people we want to be involved. So when we make a movie with real images, with children working in the mine, so that everyone in the world see how it's happening here, I think it's an opportunity and it will encourage the government of Mali and even United Nations and every organization to take action. I mean, a real action, not only saying, not only writing about it, because there are many organizations who wrote about this. There are many newspapers who made a report, who made a news about this fact, But nothing is happening. Even today, if you go in Malian mining here, we can find as many as children is there.
So, with this project, are you hoping to get a ban on child mining?
I want, because I think Western wants to know that the drugs they are buying from Mali are mined by children. If they know it, so maybe it can. The fact is that the gold demand is very high. So if Western ask gold very high, so it's an opportunity for us for this, so to exploit children to work. Maybe if the Westerners who are the buyers know how this gold is mined, maybe they could stop buying this gold and get Malian government to take real action against this and to make some kind of project of green gold project to be sure that the gold that are mined in Mali is green, is not, there are no children being exploited, and the workers in the mines are well fed, and every fact like this, so that it can be a green gold, like a green energy.
Okay. Is there a lot of interest right now in getting your film screened in other countries, in Canada and the United States?
There is interest, because Canada, United States are the main countries who buy the gold. So it's more interesting that the people from this country get interested in this kind of film to know more about the source of the gold they are buying. Because I'm sure that people are not bad everywhere. And there are the people who are exploiting the gold in the source who do the bad things. So the buyer, if you know that the gold he is buying is a blood gold, is a bad gold, is a gold that came from a child mining or child slavery, they will not buy it. And if they don't buy it, they will stop the child exploitation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for sharing this grim story with us. Is there a place on the internet people can go to get more information?
It's a website that I created, and I'm just launching a crowdfunding project in Indiegogo. But the website of the project is www.minerminer.org. Yeah, the second thing, that is the main website that redirects to our campaign, is www.childrenofbling.info. Childrenofbling.info.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this with us. Wish you well and much success in your project. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.